This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Grab a chair and sit down, get you gonna hear some news of the military nature. Relax while I give you the latest report. Sport, there never was a finer sight when all our boys were fixed to fight on D-Day, 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 D-Day. We hope they'll soon
welcome,
be coming
comrades,
back
to Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips, and with me, as always, my comrade, Nick Duke. Nick, how are you?
I, for one, welcome our new Russian overlords.
Very good. I'd like to thank Colossus for stepping in for a moment there to welcome you all to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg. Joining me, as always, my cohort, Nick Duke. And actually, this week, we're no longer the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are the Hard Travelers for Hire. That's right. It's our monthly installment in our movie-by-movie jaunt, if you will, through the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And today is a big day for us because we are wrapping up Phase 1 of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
That is not true.
In our next two installments, Nick, if you would allow me to finish, sir. Because today we are doing Captain America, the First Avenger, which is being followed by next month's extravaganza, The Avengers. So this is, I believe, Nick, the fifth entry into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And we decided to reach out to our Place to Be Nation pop companion to bring in a very special expert to talk about Captain America. Nick, tell the folks who we've got lined up for him today. Introduce our wonderful guest.
Well, he is the illustrious co-host of the wonderful WCW podcast Survey Says over on the main Place to Be Nation feed, and he is the official Hard Travelers for Hire Captain America correspondent, the dark passenger himself, Mr. Tim Capel.
Duh! In Soviet Russia, First Avenger watches you. Evening,
good.
Gentlemen. Evening, Colossus. Privilege and a pleasure to be here as always. Looking forward to this. Been looking forward to it since you decided to bring me on as your official Captain America correspondent. So I hope I can live up to the great honor and the distinction there.
Absolutely. Yes. And what people don't realize is you were doing a Colossus impression to begin with, but then you also did another Colossus impression because you were doing ultra generic American Colossus from his cameo in X2. So, two Colossus impressions from Tim Capel there.
Yes. Yes, two the Colossus with no Russian ties whatsoever, apparently, in X2. Very, very good.
Oh, goodness.
Well, we're not here to talk about Colossus, though, or about the X-Men movies. We are here to talk about Captain America, perhaps the biggest icon in Marvel Comics, certainly up there with the biggest icons in Marvel Comics. And in all seriousness, the reason that we asked Tim to join us is that Tim is a huge Captain America fan. It has been since childhood. He actually wrote a pretty excellent column on Place to Be Nation that you can find in the archives about Captain America, The Case for Cap. It's a wonderful series. Check it out in our archives. But Tim, just to catch people up, and actually before we get to that, I'm going to go ahead and start the people off on the movie. As you guys know, we always like to watch the movies on mute while we do these podcasts, and we invite you to watch along with us. We may get through the whole movie, we may not, but we mainly put it on there to remind us of certain talking points, to refresh us on certain scenes, and we invite you to watch along with us. So All three of us have our movies at 0 minutes and 0 seconds right now queued up. And so on the count of three, we're going to hit the play button. One, two, three, play. And with that being said, Tim, tell us a little bit about your affinity for Captain America. When do you first remember sort of falling in love with this character?
It's so funny. You know, I was considering that very question today in anticipation of this show. And trying to figure that out and answer it for myself, because he is and was my first favorite superhero and the first character that I followed with any real purpose or regularity as I was becoming more of a comics reader and comics fan growing up. And, you know, I think what it comes down to very simply is I couldn't quite get a read on Captain America. I couldn't really figure him out. I was young and impressionable enough that I didn't think there could possibly be any lame superheroes, right? I mean, that's just not possible. There's the superheroes that you know about, like Superman and Spider-Man and Batman. And then there's just the superheroes you haven't heard of yet. And when you make that new discovery, you really want to unpack all that and go all in, take a deep dive. And when I tried to do that with Cap, it was sort of like, well, what's his deal? What are his powers? Well, he doesn't really have any powers. Oh, okay, so he must be like Batman. He has some cool weapons, some gadgets that he uses, some sweet technology. What's he got going on? No, not really. He's got a shield. Okay, what's he do with that? He throws it sometimes. Okay, he throws his shield. So I had to, like, find a hook, you know what I mean? And find something that made this character work for me, because I couldn't accept that he was just sort of a kind of a lame superhero, to be perfectly honest, which I think is what a lot of people's impression of Cap, especially if they are really first encountering him as an adult, might come away with. So I kind of like talked myself into loving the character, I think. And reading some of the early comics, this would have been during the like early 90s that Mark Gruenwald run. The very infamous Man and Wolf, the story I've told several times, was actually my point of entry for Captain America comics. And believe it or not, I kept coming back for more. But when you're 7 years old, or however old, I was probably more like 8 or 9 years old at the time, that's the type of thing that that really speaks to you as a little kid. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It was one of those things where it was a perfect storm of the comics, the trading cards, which certainly we've talked about a great deal, the action figures that were being produced by Toy Biz during that same time period, which, you know, Cap was present throughout all of things, and certainly his rogues gallery as well was something that I thought was pretty cool. Like I took to Red Skull right away, just that great visual, crossbones and the Serpent Society, even more deep cuts like Flag Smasher and Batroc Z-Leaper. I mean, it doesn't get much better than some, as Z-list villains go, Cap's got some great ones.
Outstanding. So you came into to this movie already a huge Cap fan, obviously. And we're going to get into kind of the build-up to this movie, but I wanted to start off mentioning, as we see here on the screen, the first appearance of the character that will become the Red, that we find out later is the Red Skull. But at the beginning of the movie, they kind of started this out with an interesting framing device, where at the beginning of the film, we start in present day, where a group of scientists and explorers uncover the Captain America shield, the ship that Captain America has been frozen in, essentially. What did you guys think of starting the movie out in the present day and then transitioning to the 40s the way it was done here at the beginning of the movie? Nick?
Smart move, I thought, because by using this framing sequence, you can pretty much go ahead and know that at the end of the film, they're going to start to pull him out of the ice or whatever, and you don't have to spend valuable screen time in the Avengers doing that. You can basically have all the characters already introduced and set up and ready to roll, because a movie like the Avengers had never really been attempted before, where you had to juggle so many individual subplots and so many characters. So you know, in the light of that, with trying to fit everybody into one film, I think it made sense to have this framing sequence to avoid the classic ice rescue scene having to be crammed into the Avengers. So I really liked it. And then this kind of this jump back to the World War II era is very. This whole movie, I'm sure the most apt comparison we're going to make over the course of this, it has a very Raiders of the Lost Ark type feel to it that I absolutely love.
Yeah, it's interesting that that they would start it in the present day. I kind of found myself on the rewatch kind of thinking, man, maybe I would have started in the 40s and then kind of fast-forwarded at the end, because it almost feels like the opening sequence isn't necessarily necessary, I guess you would say, but I get where you're coming from for sure. Tim, what did you make of the opening sequence and the kind of transition into what we're seeing now?
Very much the same story. I followed the development of this film pretty closely, as you can imagine, and I knew it was going to be a period piece, so I was going in expecting it was going to have some sort of present-day type framing device where the meat and potatoes of the movie would really take place during the war, and maybe towards the end we would see Cap finding his way into the present, maybe a little bit at the beginning, just like we saw. Glad they didn't go the route of having him thawed out in the ice due to the actions of the Incredible Hulk, as was rumored. There is a deleted scene from the Ed Norton Incredible Hulk where he's in the Arctic. He's there to commit suicide, I want to say. And Hulks out and triggers an avalanche. And supposedly there's like a shield or part of a costume you can see in the background, which really isn't there. I think that's bullshit. But yeah, glad that that was not a reality.
Very good. Well, let's talk about the buildup for this movie. This is a film that was coming on the heels of some pretty big successes already for Marvel. Both the Iron Man movies were huge hits. Thor was a relatively big hit. Even the Incredible Hulk did fairly well, although not by current, you know, by modern day MCU standards. But in 2008, it was a moderate hit. So they've already kind of built a lot of their cachet. People obviously knew the Avengers were coming. Hence the, arguably lackluster title of this film, The Captain America, The First Avenger. But what were the thoughts heading into this movie? Let's start with you, Tim, as a huge Captain America fan. What were your expectations for this film heading into it? Were you expecting it to be your favorite of the movies just because it starred your favorite character? Or were you expecting, or were you just hoping for a decent movie at this point?
I was hoping for the best. I really was. But I don't want to say expecting the worst, because this is still in the early days of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But they had a little bit of a track record where first Iron Man was great. The Incredible Hulk, less so, but not bad. Iron Man 2, solid enough effort, I suppose. And Thor was where that was kind of the proving ground, where I sort of felt like Thor was the hardest sell to a general audience. So if they could get that right, they could probably pull off anything. And suffice to say, they basically got Thor right. So I had confidence that they could pull off a great Cap movie. But me being the fan that I am and having the standards that I do when it comes to these things I'm so passionate about, I knew I was going to be very, very hard on this movie, where my attitude was like, if they don't get this right, if they don't do the character right and have a tone that's really pitch perfect, then this is really going to suffer. And other people may be okay with it, may come away being pleasantly surprised, but I'm going to be a harsh grader when it comes to this movie. And I guess want to give away what my impressions were, but that's how I felt going in. And that's the same attitude I have, and that's the reason why I think I'm so hard on the X-Men movies. I mean, that's the one other major Marvel franchise that I'm potentially as passionate about, but when it comes to Cap, because here again, he's my first favorite superhero. He's a sentimental favorite. I'm a lot more defensive of him than I am even of the X-Men. Irrationally so, perhaps. So, yeah, there was a lot riding on this for me.
And from the opposite side of the spectrum, Nick, I know that you were never a Captain America fan. So what were, you know, coming from your standpoint, I remember both of us kind of being skeptical of this movie because we were like, okay, Thor was a very difficult sell to the general public. But Captain America, in so many eyes, especially in, you know, in modern era, let's just say the 21st century, kind of had this, I guess, arguably unearned kind of reputation of, I guess, lameness, of corniness, of outdatedness, if you will, where people were thinking, oh, what a relic of the past and things like that. So, Nick, what were your thoughts going into this movie? What were you expecting a good movie, or were you kind of expecting this to be the first, I guess, dropped ball for the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
I wasn't really sure what to expect. I mean, like you said, the character is kind of, during that era anyway, had kind of earned this label of, you know, a little hokey, a little cheesy, maybe a little bit of that Superman syndrome, so to speak, where you almost feel like he's too perfect in a way. Which, you know, certainly isn't indicative of some of the comics. You know, there's certainly been, you know, Cap storylines where he's struggled with his own, you know, morality and whatnot. But I was very skeptical, mainly because from a villain standpoint, I know you and I discussed, okay, well, they got the Red Skull, but can this really be a franchise for Marvel like they're looking for? And so I was hesitant, but Marvel had not done anything to that point to indicate to me that they couldn't, you know, continue to impress. I mean, even with my lowered opinion of Iron Man 2 and The Incredible Hulk, still very, very good movies, and at the time, among the best, you know, superhero movies we had seen. We did not yet live in the golden age of the superhero film.
Very true. I was worried about it, because I had seen, not that they're the same character, because they're not, but I think Tim would agree that they fill similar roles within their respective universes. I feel like I had seen so many failures with Superman over the years. You know, we were just coming off of the rather boring Superman Returns, and you know, I think that was my biggest source of concern, because Captain America, he's an easy character to get right, but he's also an easy character to get wrong, and I was worried that it would that there would be, I don't know, almost a Superman Returns-esque approach to the character, where it either treats the character so reverently that it makes him seem distant and unrelatable to the audience, or that it would, I guess, satirize the character to the point where it can no longer be taken seriously. So I had some concerns about it going in, but as we'll talk about a little bit later, the casting of this movie turned out to be another boon for Marvel. We'll get to that in just a minute, but first, let's talk about the director of the film. Joe Johnston was selected to head this one up, and he is certainly a capable director, probably most well-known for directing The Rocketeer, Jumanji, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, a lot of the, you know, 90s classics that people are aware of. You know, he's certainly a solid director, but not spectacular, not somebody that would, you know, people were super excited about going into it, but it did establish kind of the feel, I think, that they wanted for this, because Johnston has done those kind of family-friendly, big action epics, and this, in many ways, feels like a movie from the early 90s, the late 80s, in terms of the aesthetic, the way that the story progresses. It's got a lot of those classic beats to it. It certainly, I feel like anyway, is a little bit unique in the first wave of MCU movies, which is a criticism some have had of the Marvel movies, is how there's a lot of sameness there. And it feels like this one just has a different, whether it's the hue of the movie when it's in the 40s, or whether it's just the almost over-the-topness of the score. I mean, the score is extremely on the nose throughout the movie. With whatever's going on, but what did you guys think about the way that this movie kind of distinguished itself as separate from what had come before it. Tim, let's start with you on that one. Did you feel that this one felt the same as Iron Man and Thor, or did it do a good job of carving out its own identity?
It does a nice job of carving out its own identity, and that's sort of the distinction that the Marvel Cinematic Universe likes to employ with their films, or the spin that they like to put on their characters, where these are not just cardboard cutout superhero movies that are just kind of a dime a dozen. They are genre films, not just in the superhero genre, but across many different genres potentially. So you had kind of that epic fantasy thing going on with Thor, and here in Captain America, it's a period piece. I wouldn't call it a war movie necessarily, because that's not really fair, and it's not exactly that. But it's an adventure film, like in that classic mold of, you'd mentioned Raiders of the Lost Ark before. I get a lot out of that as well. Certainly, throwing it back to The Rocketeer in a lot of ways, not just the same director, but I mean the setting and
the visual style is very similar.
Yes, the visual aesthetic is pretty much spot on, and it's just whimsical. It's kind of bouncy, keeps you engaged. It's lighthearted, so it has these other elements that, even though the character himself can be a tough sell, I think you made a great point, Greg, that even if you get it right, you might still fail to connect with people, because it's like, this is just a bread and butter superhero, kind of boring guy that I can't invest it in. Well, it seems like there's enough flourishes going on around the edges here to not only get you into the character, but just keep you engaged with what's going on in the movie itself.
Yeah, and here we see Dr. Zola here. He is the every time I say – I feel bad for saying this because he does a great job of playing this really creepy villain. But every time I see him, I think of the Watchmen line. He's fabulously ugly.
Well, it's a nice little intro to him where the first we see of him, he's peering through the giant like magnifying glass, which sort of a Easter egg, if you will, or a callback to his more popular comics depiction, where he's basically a cyborg with a chest. His chest is projecting his head and his face, right? And his actual head is just a little camera sticking up.
Yeah, not unlike the bad guy robot from RoboCop 2, if you recall.
I recall that fondly, yes.
But yeah, so we're really getting into the evil layer here of I'm just gonna call him the Red Skull of Red Skull and Zola, as they are pretty much plotting. Well, Red Skull is pretty much plotting an overthrow of the Fuhrer here for his own purposes. He's created Hydra, and this is sort of the beginning of the big Hydra conspiracy that would permeate throughout the Captain America movies, and less successfully so on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And we're seeing the Tesseract, or as comic fans know it, the Cosmic Cube. Tim, you want to give us a little backstory on the Tesseract / the Cosmic Cube?
Oh, gosh. It's just one of those great Marvel cosmic MacGuffins introduced, I want to say, by Stan Lee back in the 60s run of probably Tales of Suspense, the book that when Captain America was revived in 1963, that sort of took the form of his solo title before it was properly retitled as Captain America. So it was something that the Red Skull wanted to get his hands on, this object of great power that pretty much anything within your imagination, this object, this cube, can bring to light. And there's been a lot of different competing origins for this artifact over the years in the comics, which really aren't worth getting into. So I kind of appreciate the film for streamlining and simplifying that. It's just one of the many treasures in Odin's chest, right?
Yes. which he delivers just so nonchalantly to someone who probably doesn't even believe that Odin exists. So, just a delightfully over the top version of the Red Skull, which is the only way to do the Red Skull, in my opinion, is to go way over the top with him.
It is, and that sort of gets into the whole controversy or non-controversy surrounding why isn't Captain America actually fighting Nazis in this movie, right? So, I mean, you think of this is a World War II superhero. He was created kind of as a World War II propaganda character just in these sort of trashy comics from the 40s. So you would think, if nothing else, you'd be seeing proper Nazis in this movie. But I don't know. I can understand on a couple of different levels the decision to shift focus away from that, at least Nazis as the direct villains here. As recent events have demonstrated, I think it's never unfashionable to punch a Nazi in the face. But on the other hand, this is a superhero movie. It's an origin story. And the kind of historical reality of the atrocities committed under Hitler's regime, not to mention all the really heavily loaded symbolism that's very evocative today of like the swastika. I think a lot of that would be really at odds with this film's tone.
Very light film to tackle those kind of topics.
It is. And let's face it, Nazis make people feel bad. I know that's a controversial statement, but I'll take the brave stance there, and somebody's got to do it, right? And it's a treat to see them get beaten up, sure. But at the same time, you don't want to be flippant in your treatment of some of this stuff that's pretty sensitive material at the end of the day. It's so funny how you look no further than, again, all the Indiana Jones movies, just, well, two, half of them, to see how sensibilities have really changed over the years with respect to that. Again, I have no problem seeing Nazis get punched out and treated as a joke like that, but it's still sensitive subject matter, and you wonder if they would really do something like that today. And I know that's not the only reason. There's the more cynical aspect of you want to be able to sell this movie in Germany,
right,
among other international markets. So, I mean, from the financial and just practical perspectives, you'd be stupid to tank your box office on, you know, ideological grounds or for the sake of preserving artistic integrity. It's a summer blockbuster. Come on, it's not Schindler's List.
Right. Right. Well, this is a great scene here. This to me is one of, probably the first really great scene of the movie. Because to me, this tells you everything you need to know about Steve Rogers, about Captain America.
I don't know. I would argue that the first introduction of Peggy Carter is a great scene where she decks the guy and lays him out. I thought that was a fantastic introduction to that character.
That's true. And also, something amazing is happening here and has happened over the last couple minutes. Tommy Lee Jones is redeeming himself in the eyes of comic book fans around the world. After
I wouldn't go quite that far.
A less than warmly received performance from a legendary actor as Two-Face in 1995's Batman Forever. Here he is, my favorite part of this movie. I think he is fantastic. Every time he's on screen, he was kind of the big hook for me in this movie going in. Because I'm a big Tommy Lee Jones fan outside of Batman Forever. And he did a great job of bringing a little bit of, you know, chops to the movie, I guess you would say. And certainly helps to raise up the game of everyone around him, including Chris Evans, who before this movie was primarily known, in our circles anyway, for playing the Human Torch in two not very good movies about the Fantastic
Somewhat
Four.
Somewhat unique Fantastic Four movies.
Yes, yes. Although I would strongly strongly argue that he was perhaps the best part of those movies, with what I thought was a good portrayal of Johnny Storm, even if the films around him were not good. But here he is reinventing himself again as a totally different superhero. And boy, if there was ever anybody born to play this character, it was Chris Evans. I don't think we knew it at the time, but by the time this film was over, it was apparent this guy was just another case of Marvel finding the perfect guy for the perfect role. The acting across the board in this movie is, again, really good. The casting is really strong. Nick, what were your thoughts on, I guess we'll take him in order, Tommy Lee Jones, Peggy Carter, and, of course, Steve Rogers himself, Chris Evans. What were your thoughts on the casting in this movie and the performances?
Oh, man, the casting across the board was pretty much excellent. I mean, Tommy Lee Jones brings some comedic relief in the movie throughout. Even though it's a fairly light movie, it's still important to have a character who kind of fills that role. And so his dry wit and sarcasm throughout the movie is much appreciated. Peggy Carter introduces, much in the vein of Black Widow and Iron Man 2, a very strong female character that would go on to enjoy greater success in the MCU, something I don't necessarily think they expected when they wrote her role in this movie. And then, of course, Chris Evans. I mean, people have been praising this man's portrayal of Steve Rogers for years. There's really not much more I can add to that. He is almost a perfect portrayal of both Steve Rogers in his current state as we see him on screen here, and as well, you know, the physical transformation he had to undergo to become Captain America. Chris Evans certainly put in a whole lot of work. But I want to give a little shout out here to who I feel is one of the movie's unsung heroes, and that is Stanley Tucci playing the role of Dr. Erskine, as we see on screen right now. I absolutely loved this character pretty much every time he was on screen, and to the point where I was legitimately sad whenever they killed him off here in a few scenes from now. I thought he brought some humor, some heart, just a great character to add to this movie, and kind of provides Steve with some added motivation and whatnot.
Right. I agree with you on that for sure. Interestingly enough, one thing that I think is kind of odd about this film, and this is one of my minor critiques of the film, I think the movie did a better job of establishing a relationship between Steve and the doctor there than between Steve and Bucky in the movie. For whatever reason, I just never really bought into Steve and Bucky as best friends in this one. And I don't know what it is. I don't know if it was that they needed more time to grow into their roles. But, they almost have a kind of adversarial reaction to each other at first because Bucky doesn't want him to join the military and all that stuff. I never really got the brotherly bond between them that I think I was supposed to and that is referred back to in later films. But with Steve and Doctor, there's this great bond between them that's formed. And you're right, Nick, there is that sadness that kind of overtakes you when he's gunned down by the Hydra agent.
I would agree with that. I can't exactly put my finger on what it is, the whole Cap-Bucky relationship that just isn't quite there.
Right.
Maybe it is that they needed more time to develop it. Maybe they just don't have the greatest chemistry in terms of those two actors. I'm not sure, but I haven't totally been sold on that throughout really all of these movies, in fact.
Well, for you, Tim, what did you make of the decision to, like, instead of casting them as Cap being, you know, the mentor to Bucky, having them be more of contemporaries and peers? I know that's not traditionally the take that the Captain America mythos has gone with in the comics.
I was sort of okay with it. And in a way, it almost plays out as a swerve, you know, that Bucky is not the hero of this movie. If you know nothing about the background of Steve Rogers and Captain America going into this, you might think that, oh, this is going to be this guy, Bucky, he's going to be the super soldier, right? Maybe he's Captain America. But I didn't have a problem with flipping that dynamic because the way that Bucky is introduced in the comics is essentially as Captain America's mascot who becomes his partner because he learns his secret identity. And it's really it's something that would not play well today whatsoever, especially when they don't go the route of Captain America as an actual operative in the war, except by accident, which I think they really got a good handle on that, as we'll see later on in this film. So for what they had to work with, I think they really did a decent job of salvaging some pretty shaky material from the start.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I think that in recent movies, I've gotten a little bit more chemistry out of Cap and Bucky, but I think that's something that really, it's hard to buy that past bond between them. I think you're right, Tim, that kind of dates back to this one. But back to the casting, Tim, what were your thoughts on the casting throughout this movie? Who were some of the standout performers to you? I'm assuming Chris Evans was one of them.
Well, yeah, we have to start with Chris Evans, and I will say I was skeptical going in. I was going to withhold judgment because lesson learned after Heath Ledger, as we all know. But I will say my impression at the time, this is putting myself back in my 2010, 2011 mindset, is, oh, sort of the scrubby guy from the Fantastic Four movies is going to be Cap. Could work, but I'm not real sold on that. He seemed like a weak choice. And especially in my mind, believe it or not, and I can't believe I'm even envisioning this now, but I wanted Ryan Gosling as Captain America.
Really?
And yeah, I did. Shout out to Ben Morris, who they were separated at birth, right? So, but I don't know. I had this thing. I was on kind of a Ryan Gosling kick at the time. Thought he would have been really good for the role, and thought it could be a reality. And not that there were any rumors to that effect or anything. It was just sort of
he's not maybe as big as Cap would normally be, but he kind of has the look. I can see it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to, not to interrupt here, but I know that this is probably one of the last times we see this effect on screen. So I want to throw a quick shout out to the Skinny Steve effects that the special effects department put to life here. I thought it was an amazing job of CGI on the part of Marvel Studios. Unbelievable how realistic they were able to make this look.
Yeah. If anything, I imagine audiences would have assumed that they CGI'd his more buff appearance, but it's Skinny Steve who gets the CGI treatment, because Chris Evans really hit the gym hard going into this movie, so to say the least, and personal trainers, of course. But no, but when I finally saw him on screen, especially as, like you put it, Skinny Steve, there was just a real earnestness to him right away, where I thought, okay, he has the chops to pull this off. The movie may be what it is, the script, the directing, plot, but as a performer, I think Chris Evans has got this, and I have confidence in him now as the Cap fan that I am. And wow, did they nail the look. I mean, he doesn't even really look like the same actor that he was in Fantastic Four, and that's not just speaking in terms of his physique, of course, but I mean, he just seemed like kind of this young punk guy, which Johnny Storm kind of is, and to switch gears as much as he did, not just in his physical appearance, but just his entire demeanor, that to him, and something that really surprised me. I did not know that Chris Evans was really that caliber of an actor.
It's to his credit that he pulls off something, and this is about as non-technical a way of putting it as you could possibly get, so I apologize to any students of film out there that may be listening to our show, but the thing to me, the key to me to someone playing Captain America is the same as the key to playing Superman. The audience, when you view him in the costume, when you view him talking to other characters, you have to believe that he's a good person. And I don't know a thing about Chris Evans, but in this movie, when he says things, I believe them. I trust him. I feel like he's a good person, and that's kind of a very subjective quality. But it's the same thing with, like, Christopher Reeve in the original Superman.
Yeah, I was going to say exact same thing. He's just so convincing.
Yep. When he looks at the camera and he smiles, or when he looks at a person and says something, you're like, gosh, he just seems like a great person, like a great human being. And, well, in Superman's case, a great Kryptonian, I guess, but you know what I mean. It's that, like you said, that earnestness, that ability to get you to believe that he's just one of, you know, like you said before about Superman, just the best person, the best possible person. And that's what you get with Chris Evans in this movie.
He makes you want to believe in him.
Yep.
And beyond that, I mean, we talked about Hayley Atwell, of course. I like that. Yeah, she is they're doing the strong, independent woman, right, with her, but they're not laying it on so thick that it feels like a cliche, which often the case that is with these types of movies. I mean, she does have that scene where she punches the guy out, right, to establish that she's like this very no-nonsense sort of ball buster type. But I like that the movie presents her so matter-of-factly as someone who's rank and authority basically goes unchallenged. You don't have guys, you know, getting handsy with her or making shitty comments or like, I mean, yeah, they are sort of objectifying her, but they know that, like, she is so completely out of their league.
Speaking of objectifying.
Right. Well timed, I suppose. But, you know, it's just one of those things where the filmmakers, they clearly have enough respect for the script, for Hayley Atwell's performance, for the intelligence of their audience, not to make a big show of that, that let the character speak for herself. And it comes off very, very well. And I think that's why immediately you look at her and you're kind of drawn to her, and she has that same sort of likability.
Now, I'm familiar with Sharon Carter from the comics. Was Peggy Carter part of the comics as well, or was she an original character for the MCU?
Yep, she was the love interest during the war, and Sharon is her niece or maybe grandniece by now, so that there is still that rather awkward element of Steve having these love interests across generations like that. But yeah, Peggy is from the comics.
We haven't even touched really on Hugo Weaving's performance as Red Skull, but like I mentioned earlier, if you're going to do Red Skull, I think you have to go over the top, and certainly he goes way over the top in this one. Was it too much for either of you, or did you guys feel like I did, that it was pretty much the right amount of over the top for the Red Skull?
No, I thought it was great. I mean, again, to draw that Indiana Jones parallel, I thought it was very reminiscent of Belloc, you know, kind of the over the top nature of that character back in Raiders of the Lost Ark. So everything of it, you know, everything about that portrayal really worked for me, from the visual look to the dialogue, to the cadence, pretty much everything Weaving did here. I really, really enjoyed it, and makes me wish that they would find a way to bring him back at some point, given that we now know that the Tesseract is the Space Stone. So theoretically, he could still be out there somewhere in the MCU.
Yeah, I was going to say the exact same thing. If anything, I felt like we haven't seen enough of this portrayal. He was pitch perfect for me. That's how you want your Red Skull to come across. Mm-hmm. We talked about how you can't do realistic, actual Nazis in like a historical fiction type of bent in this movie. You want to play it to the cheap seats to a certain degree. And I think Hydra is a really nice compromise in that vein, in that they are sufficiently Nazi-esque, but have the advantage of not being, you know, a real, actual, real-life group with a lot of loaded imagery and symbolism that could potentially make people uncomfortable. And they're just so super pulpy, and that's what you want in this type of high adventure, almost high stakes, but at the same time, nothing really bad is going to happen type of setting for a war movie. Not a, we talked about how it isn't a war movie, but a period piece. So yeah, I mean, as the leader of the as the leader of Hydra, as a force that's supposedly even more evil than the Nazis, right? That they just they made the right choice, I think, and I truly enjoy Hugo Weaving's performance, and we haven't seen enough of him. Like, he's got to be floating around somewhere in Asgard. Why are we not seeing him, like, presiding over an army of undead Nazi demigod Asgardian Viking something or others? You know,
I,
like,
remember for a while being convinced that Robert Redford was going to peel off his face.
Hold on. Baby Walter Kovacs just got thrown into the river.
I remember being convinced for a while that Robert Redford was going to peel his face off in The Winter Soldier and reveal himself to be the Red Skull.
But, you know, I was sort of having that in the back of my mind too, but I don't know. Maybe it's for the best, but
No.
That would have been in keeping with the great Red Skull reveals that have taken place in the comics, I will say. So I'm not sure. Depending on if they had done that, it might have been the tipping point for some people, but I don't know. If it was used to good effect, I think I would have been all in on that.
I want to write a Captain America movie where, you know, you've got an actor and he unmasks to reveal the Red Skull, but then the Red Skull unmasks and it's still the Red Skull with a Red Skull mask on just for no reason. But
wearing a jean jacket over leather jacket over jean jacket, of course.
Yes.
Of course.
This is much like Zorn posing as Magneto posing as Zorn.
Absolutely.
Right.
One thing before we move on from the casting, one piece that we haven't even touched on is one of the other recurring characters that this gave the MCU, and that's Dominic Cooper as Howard Stark. I thought he also provided, you know, kind of a little bit of levity here to the proceedings, and kind of this almost like this beta version of what we know Tony Stark would become in the movie. So I very much enjoyed Howard's, you know, relatively minor presence in the movie.
By the way, the sequence that we just watched with Steve and Peggy Carter chasing the Hydra agents after they kill the scientists and try to steal the formula, my favorite action sequence of the movie. I think it's the one action scene in this film that really did it for me. I was a big fan of that one. But yeah, to your point about Howard Stark, very true. He instantly falls into that kind of Playboy motif that we've come to expect from Tony, and you see that the apple really hasn't fallen far from the tree, which is especially interesting given that both of the Iron Man movies tackle some of the issues that Tony had with his dad, and you come to realize that Tony and his dad are actually a lot more similar than they were different.
Yeah, that's sort of an advantage that we have viewers have on Tony Stark the character, where we get to see through this film what his dad was really like and contrast that with his own perception and his memories, which normally we would be biased to sort of just agree with. Since, I mean, he's a fairly reliable narrator of his own films as a protagonist, but we get to see that other side to it here. So yeah, I kind of enjoyed that. Didn't expect him to play much of a role in this movie beyond, like, maybe having a cameo, but it's sort of neat that he is a pretty fully formed character in this.
Right, and you see as we are learning and seeing the coup is being executed. Essentially, Hydra is pretty much done with the Nazis now. They've gotten what they needed, and they're ready to implement their own plot for world domination. So,
yes, even more evil than the Nazis, you know.
More evil than Satan himself.
Exactly.
And he turns his Dr. Manhattan gun here on them as they vaporize into blue mist or whatever.
The tachyons. We're really overdoing it with the Watcher reference in this one, but it just keeps coming up. So the tachyon particles and all that.
I will say that was maybe the one element that I had a little bit of a hard time with in this movie, just the how casual they are in using this very futuristic technology. I mean, at times I was sitting there going, all right, now this is turning into like a G.I. Joe cartoon. You know what I mean? With, you know, laser blasts going back and forth just all over the place. So
not the spores!
But it's a very, very minor gripe. It's at the end of the day, it's fine. It's just, it is a little bit jarring.
Yeah. I get where you're coming from. It's kind of a, you see the same thing at times on, pretty much any time they do a comic book superhero related show where there's time travel involved, Legends of Tomorrow, for instance, or whatever, where people in the past don't really have the, at times don't really have the flabbergasted reaction to futuristic technology that you would expect. They just pick up the laser gun and they're like, hey, a laser gun.
Yeah.
But, you know, it, like you said, it's part of the, kind of part of the genre at this point. So here we see Steve is going to be recruited to go on this, what for some is a bit of a controversial part of this movie, where they kind of do the 40s propaganda piece, where he goes from town to town trying to sell war bonds. Funny, I remember watching the theater and laughing and enjoying the rather 1940s classical Captain America costume that they gave him. But some of my friends that I watched it with at the time didn't like this sequence. They found it, you know, unnecessary, I guess you would say, and they thought it was kind of boring. Where do you guys fall on the sequence? Because the first time I saw it, I loved it. On the rewatch, I like the idea of it. I kind of wonder if it was a little bit of wasted real estate when, you know, there were some aspects such as the Bucky relationship that probably could have been expounded upon instead. But what do you guys think about it? Did it work for you? It certainly at the theater, it worked to get people laughing. So what are your thoughts on this, Nick? I'll start with you.
It absolutely worked for me. I think the intent was to kind of pay homage to all eras of Captain America. And there was, you know, in his early days, Captain America was used as largely a very propaganda-esque, you know, character. I mean, he was essentially very jingoistic, patriotic, and very over the top in that nature. So this kind of works for me as an homage to that era, and kind of helps it to have this feeling of kind of taking a little bit of all the eras of Cap that people know and love, and kind of making this this smorgasbord of Captain America in this film.
My thoughts exactly, and I'll go a step further in saying that that scene is actually what sold me on this movie, where I was pretty into it. It was humming along and pulling my interest, and I wasn't watching it, you know, with my hands in front of my face or anything like the first X-Men movie, hoping they wouldn't drop the ball. But when they did this, I was like, okay, they nailed it. They know what they're doing. It has that very meta element going for it, where you can risk taking the source material too seriously and doing too literal an adaptation, and in the process lose the spirit of that source material and the spirit of the very character. And they don't do that here. They, as Nick said, pay homage to it. You get to see Cap deck Hitler a couple of times, in fact. But they avoid that risk of going too literal with it, you know. So it pays some of that stuff off. You even get to see the classic Captain America comic strips. So I'm sort of a sucker for that type of thing. I thought mm-hmm. they employed it really well here. So after that, I was like, all right, the movie knows it's its own entity. It doesn't have to be so super beholden to the comics, especially comics that frankly aren't very good. So to do that, to at least acknowledge where it came from, but in a way that's a little bit slapstick, I genuinely appreciate it. So that's where I was like, I am in this movie. At this point, it's built up so much goodwill that if it's all downhill from here, I think I'll still walk away a happy camper.
It's a little bit like Geoff Johns did with Aquaman and embracing the jokes as opposed to hiding from them. So I definitely can appreciate where you guys are coming from on that. I think on rewatches of this, I still feel like there was so much more they could have done with the Bucky relationship, because especially with the benefit of hindsight and how important it's become in the later Captain America movies, that it kind of bugs me that we don't get that relationship a little bit more. But on the other hand, I kind of wouldn't want to lose that sequence either, because like you guys said, it's very, very valuable in terms of what it does, the effect that it has on the audience. This is kind of an interesting scene because I took this almost as kind of the one morose scene in the movie where there's a little bit of comedic element to it. They're making fun of his costume, but the implication I get is that the soldiers that are out there on the front lines, almost even a darker scene. It's a gray hue to the screen, and these guys aren't really interested in having some dude in a costume come out and lecture them about war bonds and everything, or try to raise their spirits. You know, they're out there dying, and this guy's wearing a colorful getup and not really doing anything in their eyes. So I liked this scene as well.
Which would play pretty true to life when you think about it. And it's the frustration of now Cap is always – Steve Rogers has always had the right head for this type of thing, and he didn't need the lesson in power and responsibility, right, that Peter Parker mm-hmm. needed. Mm-hmm. He's always sort of been that type of – person where he's very driven and determined and goal oriented, but hasn't had the ability to back it up. And now that he has the ability, he can't do anything with it. Sort of been, treated as a sideshow because the army doesn't know how he fits anymore. He's sort of like this. He's not a failed experiment. It obviously worked, but they don't know how to capitalize on what he can do and how he can contribute at this point. So it makes sense to take sort of a downbeat tone when dealing with that development. So yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, this is still a pretty bouncy movie, but you get that little infusion of humanity early here in Cap's career.
Yeah, and we also see the kind of burgeoning, not yet romantic relationship, but relationship between Peggy and Steve throughout the movie. She kind of almost takes him under her wing, so to speak, and is interested in motivating him to do more with what he's got. And then, of course, he finds out that Bucky's in trouble, and it sets off the second half of the movie, basically. Looking at kind of, I mentioned earlier the action scene in New York. This is kind of, in many ways, in my opinion, a typical Marvel movie in terms of the action. It's not really reinventing the wheel, not a very dynamic action in terms of what we would get with Winter Soldier, for instance, or even Civil War. But I can't really knock it for that because none of the Marvel movies to this point had really had what I would consider to be spectacular action. What did you guys make of the action scenes in this film? I know that there was the standout one for me anyway in New York, but which ones stood out to you and which ones kind of underwhelmed you, I guess you could say, or were there any that underwhelmed you?
I would say nothing really underwhelmed me in terms of the action in this movie. And it is, like you said, kind of what you come to expect with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where they do leave you a little bit wanting more. I thought on the whole it was better than Thor, which yeah. I thought was, I'll just go ahead and say, wussier than I wanted a Thor movie to be in terms of its just
the action.
Overall yeah. fight choreography and action.
Right.
So it was an improvement in that respect, but it's really not until the sequel that things really heat up there. That's for sure. So, but I mean, anything where you get to see the Shield in play, I mean, that's all done really well. As unbelievable as it is that he can do that, I mean, Spider-Man has the great line, of course, in Civil War, this thing does not obey the laws of physics whatsoever. That's okay. It still works, and it still looks really cool.
Definitely. Nick, your thoughts?
Yeah, like you said, I mean, clearly the standout action scene is probably the chase sequence in New York, but I also enjoyed the final assault on the base, like on the Hydra base near the end of the film. Like Tim said, you kind of get to see your first extended look at the Shield in action, kind of banging off corridors and whatnot, so it's got a cool visual aspect to it. I also remember vividly that, for some reason, that image that sticks in my head is, as they're preparing to make the assault on the base, that image of the Hydra troopers with the flamethrowers kind of trapping Cap in the triangle or whatever, and I always, mm-hmm. it's always stuck out mm-hmm. in my head for some reason. So those are the two I would point to, and like Tim said, I don't think anything truly underwhelms so much as it is, you know, I kind of find myself forgetting the finer details of them here years later.
Yeah, I think this first wave of Marvel movies, you know, there were a couple of really good standout action scenes in Iron Man 2. While this first wave was finding out what they could do, I think it really wasn't until the Avengers and then kicking off the second wave that they really started trying to, some of them anyway, started trying to expand and see what they could do in terms of making some really visually interesting action, which I know some people out there might be thinking, hey, what does it matter? It's just action scenes, but comic books are a visual medium, man, and action scenes matter in comics. Tim and I have talked about it a lot, that it's kind of a dying art at times in comics. You see really dynamic action scenes. And that's the one element of Phase 1 of Marvel that may not have been there as much, but we get it certainly in spades in Phase 2. So,
admittedly, I will say that they do sometimes swing that pendulum too far in the other direction. I'm thinking in terms of that opening action scene in Age of Ultron that looked, to my eyes anyway, atrocious, where they're all like jumping out at the screen and it looks like a cartoon. Just the CGI, the way, way over CGI'd action and some of that did not work for me. Not to say this movie is CGI by any means, but they were certainly a bit more restrained. And if it's the difference between that and what we got here, I think I'm happier with what we got.
Yeah, and it keeps things certainly grounded in a Cap movie. I think what we would see in Winter Soldier and in Civil War was kind of a progression in the level of thought put into the fight scenes, I guess. You know, like I think especially of the Batroc fight scene from Winter Soldier, which still probably one of my favorite fight scenes in the MCU. But in this one, we right now we're getting an infiltration scene, and we're getting introduced to one of my favorite Marvel names, Dum Dum Dugan. Gotta love Dum Dum Dugan, played by the outstanding Neil McDonough, famous for playing a variety of bad guy roles, whether it be in Walking Tall opposite The Rock, or whether it be Damian Dark on Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow. He always seems to play a scumbag, but he's great here in a heroic role as the lovable Dum Dum Dugan. But tell the people out there, Tim, about this group that Dum Dum Dugan kind of is the seemingly de facto leader of.
Well, they are the Howling Commandos from bygone days of war comics. So remember how superhero comics didn't actually dominate the landscape of the comics market? We probably don't in our lifetimes, but comics used to be a pretty cyclical medium in terms of superheroes would be hot, then they'd cool off, and you'd get crime comics coming into fashion, and then like westerns and romance and funny animals. And there was a time where war comics were really all the rage. And it was, you know, you of course had Sergeant Rock from what we now know as DC, then I guess either National or well, you guys would know better than I would, I think. But from Marvel than Timely or Atlas or Chip Edeen or whatever they called themselves at the time to navigate their various distribution channels. You had Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos, and of course, Sergeant Fury referring to Nick Fury, who would be like reconceptualized in the Marvel Silver Age as this James Bond type secret agent, where Jim Steranko would do some really cutting edge work, and eventually they did some flashbacks to when he was heading up the Howling Commandos, and so you had these wartime comics, which certainly Dum-Dum Dugan was kind of his second in the actual comics. Here he's more the leader because we don't see Fury in this movie, which is a little bit surprising to me. Well, I guess we do see him at the end, but
yes,
he doesn't play a part in the wartime setting. And maybe that was just them still trying to figure out what the take on Fury was going to be. Is he
expressly said if he's got like the delayed aging factor in the MCU? They have never really like clarified
the Infinity formula, not to be confused with the Infinity Stones or the Infinity Gems, but that explains how he is so long lived. But they haven't gone there in the movie, right?
Yeah. So we do meet Dum-Dum, not Hacksaw Dugan. Or Duggan, and the Howling Commando.
Dugan, yeah,
I remember Colonel Mustafa always used to call him Hacksaw Dugan for some reason, the Iron Cheek, if you will. But that's off topic. Jennifer Smith, you can look that one up too. That's Colonel Mustafa Hacksaw Dugan. That just made the list.
By the way, I really like the sort of rapport here between Schmidt and Zola, where they just kind of have that banter and that nice, they just play off of each other so well. And
not a scratch.
Right. That's the scene I'm thinking of, where the typical thing to do would be for him to like kill his henchmen to establish again how evil he is, but he knows this guy has been valuable and loyal and could come in handy one day again. And you know, he hooks him up and sends him on his way. So that was a nice little touch that I really appreciated.
And hey, gotta give him credit, but Schmidt's car is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's actually nice to his henchmen. I mean, who would have thought the Red Skull has like a soft spot for this dude?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of, well, not exactly like Lex and Mercy, but some no. reason, you know.
Certainly not like Lex and Otis.
No, not like Lex and Otis, who, that was Ned Beatty, right?
Yep.
There's a Captain America connection there. Do you guys know what it is?
Oh my gosh.
Let's see. I'm trying to
was
think.
Was Ned Beatty in the 90 Captain America?
Yes, he sure was.
I thought I remember that.
Who did he play?
He was like the oh my gosh, now we have a RoboCop connection. The president in the 1990s Captain America movie was none other than Ronnie Cox. So,
no
Dick Jones.
Dick Jones. He worked for Dick Jones.
Exactly.
Wow.
So and
who did Beatty play in the Captain America movie?
He was like Ronnie Cox, the president, Dick Jones's childhood friend, who, like, they grew up together and they were still tight after he became president. And I think he gets killed or something happens to him in that movie where basically he gets figuratively fucked in the ass, not literally as he was in Deliverance, but as Ned Beatty does and throughout many of his roles, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yes. The biggest memory I have of the 1990 Captain America movie is here we see the first confrontation between Captain America and the Red Skull and the reveal of the Red Skull. But my biggest memory of that 90 movie is Captain America using a trash can lid and flinging it around like the shield at some point, which
he does
kind of
that.
Yeah. So,
and he had rubber ears on his costume, which are made fun of. This is a great scene right here, first confrontation between the two of them. We start to see something is not quite right with old Johann Schmidt. The Red Skull in that 90s precursor to this was played by, Scott Paulin, who it's not a name you would know, but a character actor you may recall from the college years of Beverly Hills 90210. He was none other than Professor Randall.
Yes.
And now we've had we have the great unmasking.
Yep. Classic. And a great line, a great cap line here. Unlike you, I embrace it proudly, without fear. Then how come you're running? I don't know why I made him sound like Bane, by the way, but I mean, they're kind of similar, I guess, but in some ways. But yeah, so Cap just saving Bucky here. And
by the way, he gets to be Red Skull for the rest of this movie. He doesn't put a new mask on or anything. It's
they don't pull a Jack Nicholson Joker with it, for lack of a better term.
Precisely.
If you're going to leave, leave with smile.
Here we go. So, nice.
Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit about the casting, the action. We talked a little bit about the direction. Let's kind of, I guess, start the process of overall evaluations of our thoughts on this one. It sounds like we all enjoyed it to varying degrees. What were, I guess, were there any areas of the movie that didn't work for you? I know, Nick, that your feelings on this one have evolved over the years. You first didn't like it that much, and then you said every rewatch you tend to like it more.
Well,
what are your thoughts on this one, and what are some of the are there any weaknesses still to this one that stand out to you?
Well, I've always enjoyed the film. I mean, from the first time I saw it, I liked it. It's just it was always, you know, for a long time I would have thought it was probably one of my least favorite entries in the MCU, and then over the years, as I've seen it more and more, it's the rare film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that seems to get better every time I watch it. And I think that's because I kind of understand what they were going for more. I kind of get the more the homage. I can appreciate those references and that, you know, again, Indiana Jones-like feel. I like the period piece aspect of it. I like the kind of schlocky nature of it. I like how, you know, delightfully over-the-top a lot of it is. And I just kind of, I guess I just kind of warm to the overall concept of the entire movie more and more as time goes on. To the point where I would say probably the only thing that doesn't really work for me in this is, as you said, Greg, you know, they don't really flesh out Steve and Bucky. And also they have, like, the Howling Commandos who aren't really given characters at all. They're just kind of generic stand-ins, you know, for you know, any kind of soldier squad and whatnot. So with the exception of fleshing out those side characters, I can't really think of anything in this one that doesn't work for me now having seen it, you know, probably upwards of 10 times.
Tim, what about you?
Well, I said I was going to be holding this to some pretty lofty standards going in, and when I left the theater after the credits rolled, certainly after the post-credit sequence as well, I have to say it delivered on my expectations. I really love this movie. I really do. That was my first impression. It has not evolved over time. I've probably watched this the most of any Marvel films, and I just love it as much as I did on that same viewing. And my very minor gripes, which I've mentioned throughout this recording, are not really even worth paying lip service to. I mean, they're so just beneath commentary, I feel like, compared to everything that this movie gets right for me and as a fan, that it's sort of one of those things where it kind of circled back around on me and my biases and my preference for this character that were, you know, coloring how I was going to perceive it walking out the door. Now, liking the character as much as I do, liking this movie and thinking it did right by the character as much as it did, I hold it in extremely high regard. This is probably, I would say, still a top five entry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe for me.
Very cool. Very cool. It also, since we're seeing, and we've talked about it being a period piece, it kind of raises the question. We've talked about how this movie necessarily has kind of a light, pulpy kind of tone to it, you know, a bouncy feel to it. Would it be possible? We've talked about the, you know, Howling Commandos, and then certainly with DC, you've got Sergeant Rock and characters like that. Would it be possible for DC or Marvel to do a grittier or a more traditional war comic movie? Or is it something that the audience probably wouldn't accept? Like, for instance, Wonder Woman appears to be set in World War I. This one's set in World War II. But I'm assuming Wonder Woman will have a similar tone to Captain America that will be, you know, fairly light and over the top. Is it something where there's just too much do you have any faith, basically, that one of the comic studios could handle a wartime movie based around the Howling Commandos or based around Sergeant Rock or a character like that? Nick?
I would certainly think that that Marvel could probably handle it, given their parent company, Disney, just kind of did that in the Star Wars universe. They kind of made a Star Wars movie made through the lens of a epic war movie with Rogue One. So I think there is precedent there, and I think they could do it, although I don't know that that's necessarily likely, given the fact that Marvel seems more intent on expanding their universe forward right. rather than reaching backward into past times.
Yeah, I think they could. At this point, I think they could do anything they set their minds to, in all honesty. Certainly, there are characters that lend themselves to that type of treatment better than others. I'm just trying to think in terms of, like, if they had tried to do a gritty, realistic Captain America in the war right. type of movie, I think that would have come off very badly.
Right.
So it would definitely depend on the source material. With maybe if they did revisit the Howling Commandos, tried to do more of a traditional, I don't know, maybe they're in the Pacific Theater or something type of thing, mm-hmm. where they're really cut off from any sort of capes and spandex and futuristic technology. You could do it, but there's sort of the question, is it worth doing? Like Nick said, it's because right. it's not necessarily going to be forward looking. And where do you go from that? What's your objective? But is it possible? Sure. I think so.
And here, this is a scene, with the Howling Commandos that has one little thing that I thought was funny. So that they have this kind of, round table discussion where Steve's recruiting the commandos to join him, and the French member of the Howling Commandos, I believe he's French anyway, begins speaking in French, and no one can understand him, and except for the one guy to his right, who then says, "We're in." The only issue I have with that is all of the Germans in this film speak English with a German accent. But this guy speaks French.
I think that's also, again, kind of playing into the over-the-top nature of it, because that's kind of been a well-worn tradition, again, to draw the parallel to Indiana Jones, kind of the Germans who speak English with the German accent.
Right.
Verisimilitude, just lean into it. Just go with it.
You know, it's kind of weird. That's part of it, though, Greg. I mean, like, I think part of little things like that kind of up the cheese factor have made me enjoy this more. Because, like I said, I continue to appreciate more and more what the movie is, as opposed to, I guess, my initial disappointment with what it wasn't back then.
This is not quippy and witty in the way that, like, an Iron Man movie is. Like, you think of the rapid-fire dialogue between him and Pepper that, you know, gets everybody going. I mean, this is more cornball in its humor, but it just works. I mean, it works for the character. It works for the movie. So, yeah, I feel the same way. I think I appreciate it all the more for those little touches.
Yeah, and it's weird because I would actually – you know, this is one that I was kind of low on the first time I saw it, and I definitely liked it more on this rewatch. I liked it a lot more on this rewatch, actually. I still don't think I like it as much as you two do, But I definitely appreciate what they went for and enjoy it. Even if the sequels are more to my wheelhouse, I guess you would say. But I definitely enjoy what they're going for. You have to keep in mind, also, I've never seen the Indiana Jones movies except for the bad ones. Or the bad one, I guess you would say.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah, Greg's never seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is
people out
there in podcast world, shame this man. Shame.
I've seen Temple of Doom. Sadly enough, I've seen Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, but I've not seen Raiders and I've not seen The Last Crusade.
Wow. And here on screen, I just wanted to call out a little cameo. This actress is actually Natalie Dormer, who went on to have a fairly substantial role on the current HBO hit show Game of Thrones here in a bit part. So good for Steve Rogers. Good.
And I will say that it's very validating to me as a Captain America fan, a lifelong Captain America fan as I am, that it's sort of generally acknowledged that he's the character whose solo outings in the Marvel Cinematic Universe have gotten progressively better.
Yeah,
I think this may actually be my favorite of the Cap movies, mainly because it had that jolt of just seeing it on screen for the first time. Like, wow, this is Captain America. This is his origin. They're actually getting it right. And just, you can't replicate that, you know, even if the sequel is better in terms of what it sets out to accomplish and, you know, hitting all the right notes. Just the feeling that I came away with, again, leaving out of the theater after this movie, where I felt like I wanted to go out and do community service or something, you know, like it's just, it was downright inspiring. Yeah. And that's how you want a Captain America movie to make you feel.
Right. Inspirational and aspirational.
Yeah. And, but I do love just that he's like had the best movies of any of the solo characters in the MCU. And that's just very validating to me as a fan, because it's like, you sold this character short. Maybe you didn't know what to expect, thought he was a little bit hokey. And look, he's killing it at the box office, killing it with these movies. They're all good. They keep getting better, at least according to popular opinion. So I just, it warms the heart to see that.
Yeah, the best compliment I can pay this movie is, it made me revisit Captain America, a character I hadn't really considered since I was a kid. You know, when I was a kid, I played the Captain America in the Avengers game and loved it, obviously. But I've mentioned before on this podcast, I never read the quote-unquote Avengers comics when I was young, really. I never read Cap, Iron Man, Thor, any of that stuff when I was a kid. I was an X-Men kid, so that was kind of my corner of the Marvel Universe. And, of course, because it was the 90s, Ghost Rider and crap like that. But this movie was the first time I had even really considered the Captain America character since I was a kid. And it really made me want, you know, revisit him and think, you know what, this is a valid character. This is an interesting character. And there's stuff to be mined there. And it's interesting because I never had that. I always knew what Superman's value was, and I think it took this movie for me to remember or for me to realize the value that Captain America has in the MCU, where he is that inspirational figure, that guy that you turn to, that is the morally incorruptible force in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So definitely I have to give this movie credit for that, for opening my eyes to a character that I'll admit I was like a lot of people in that I had dismissed the character over the years, and unfairly so, certainly. So real quick, speaking of Captain America from the comics, we've talked in a few of the podcasts about how the MCU was a little bit, or even in some cases a lot, influenced by the Ultimates. I would argue that this version of Captain America, less so.
Yes.
Visually, yes. But character-wise, much more in the classic Captain America vein, I think, than...
And probably to its benefit.
Yes. I would argue.
I would have to concur. In a way, on the one hand, it's unfortunate that the Ultimate imprint cooled off as hard and fast as it did at the time that the MCU was really heating up. I think Mark Miller had that sort of famous line where, well, we called them the Ultimates because you can't make a movie called the Avengers. That's just stupid. And look what happened. who's going to make a movie called the Ultimates now? And so it seemed like that was the direction for a while in the early 2000s, where the Ultimate imprint was sort of that version of the characters that was meant to be more mass marketed and really sold to the public. We felt like that's what we're going to see on film. And it didn't really materialize that way. Certainly elements in the way that it just modernized and streamlined some of these backstories, yes. But the visual depictions and the characters they owe a lot more to classic Marvel storytelling. And in a way, I sort of think we dodged a bullet. I'm not trying to be respectful of the Ultimate line. It's just there is a sense I have that it was of its time and isn't timeless in the way that, you know, this version that we're seeing right here of Steve Rogers is.
I would agree. I think character-wise, the Ultimate version of Tony Stark and, of course, Ultimate Nick Fury were probably the two biggest character influences. But otherwise, I completely agree with you that Ultimates was, and I've mentioned this when we reviewed it in our column, of its time. It's very much of that 2005-06 kind of era. And it would have been out of place on the big screen. And certainly in the case of Captain America.
Can you hear Chris Evans saying, you think this A on my head stands for France?
No, but I kind of want to now.
That's a thought I've had too. And a lot of that I think does come from Miller, where that stuff is just so cynical, and there's a place for it, and a lot of it does work and is entertaining as all get out, but not something I necessarily want to see in the movies, where it would just be doing like the grimdark thing for all of these films.
Yeah, hey, you guys still there?
Yeah, here.
I think we lost Tim.
Oh, well. Oh, sorry. I accidentally muted myself.
Oh, that's right.
But, I was just saying a lot of that, I think, comes from Miller's sensibilities, where he's pretty cynical in terms of his superhero writing, and that's not something I would want to see in these films. At least not as pervasive as it was throughout the Ultimate.
Sure, yeah. I think there's a place for it, but I think that these are the icons. This is building up for a whole generation of kids who had never picked up a comic in their life. This was their chance to see who Captain America was, what this character represents. And I think they did a great job of largely focusing on the classical interpretations of these characters, maybe with the exception of Tony Stark, who we've talked before. The classical version of Tony Stark is incredibly boring. So I'm thankful that they modernized him a little bit, but there you saw the devastating fall of Bucky and
Bucky's last stand. Oh wait,
or was it? Dun dun dun.
Well, with that being said, obviously we all enjoyed this movie. Another stellar entry in the MCU, as we're seeing through each of these podcasts. We're seeing as the MCU, the bricks are being laid for the foundation, and it's all setting up for what's coming for us next month, which is the Avengers, which is kind of the culmination of all of this that's been coming. And it was an event to itself, but
it wasn't a movie. It was an event.
It was an event. So, Tim, do you have any of your final thoughts about Captain America: The First Avenger that you'd like to let people know?
Well, as we're wrapping up here on this scene of Arnim Zola sitting down to a steak dinner, I find myself getting a little hungry.
Yeah, me too.
Because that does look like a good steak he's got in front of him. No, I think I've said all that needs to be said. Coming from where I was at in my fandom and my adoration for this character, the movie checked off all the boxes for me, as they say, and it absolutely got me pumped for the Avengers, which I'll go ahead and say is still my absolute favorite, my favorite entry in the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe is that first Avengers. But as a lead into that, this movie did its job, but also stands on its own tremendously well in making Cap just that major player that he needs to be in order to stand toe-to-toe with characters like Tony Stark and a god and Thor. This certainly did its job in setting him up. I've really enjoyed watching it again. This is once again the film I've watched the most, and it's holds up remarkably consistently. I love it just as much as I did the first time around, and this has been no exception. I think I'm going to keep watching it even after we wrap up here.
Awesome, and hang with us because we're going to come back to you one last time. But Nick, it's that time of Hard Travelers for Hire when we have to rank them up to this point. We're five movies in, so it's starting to get a little harder, starting to get a little more interesting, and our lists are starting to diverge a little bit more. Certainly my controversial ranking of the Iron Man movies plays into that. But Nick, what's your rankings to this point after Captain America, the first Avenger?
All right, are we going 1 to 5 or 5 to 1?
Oh, I say let's go 1 to 5 because I think we've been doing it that way with these. Or do you want to go 5 to 1? It's your call.
All right, we'll shake things up again to go 5 to 1. I'll go 5, The Incredible Hulk, 4, Iron Man 2, 3, Captain America, The First Avenger, 2, Thor, and 1, still the reigning, defending, undisputed champion, Iron Man.
And I am going to go at number 5, The Incredible Hulk, at number 4, Captain America, The First Avenger, at number 3, actually, I'm going to change that, rewatch. I'm going to go 4, Thor, 3, Captain America, The First Avenger, 2, Iron Man, and 1, Iron Man 2. Controversial, yes, folks, but I'm sticking by it for now. And with that being said, let's go back to Tim one last time because you, sir, are doing fantastic work on Survey Says, the WCW podcast. I want you to tell people where they can find that and what you might have coming up.
As our guest, Greg, should we get Tim's ranking of these five to this point?
Oh, okay. Sure.
Absolutely. No, I would love to. It's funny. If you ask me this question when did this come out? 2011 versus today, 5, 6, whatever, however many years later. Can't do math right now.
Almost 6 years.
Which is hard to believe. But
so many movies have come out since then that it feels a lot longer.
Yes, it does.
I guess because of the MCU's frequent release schedule, it makes it feel like almost more than a decade ago that this existed. But it really...
God, I wish I had a frequent release schedule again.
Okay.
Watch Iron Man 2. Never mind.
Oh, wait a minute. Not that kind, Nick. I was referring to the, the more digestive kind, but that's fine.
All that is to say, I don't think that my rankings would be tremendously different then versus today. So I will go Incredible Hulk. I'm pretty meh on that. Then I would say Thor, Iron Man 2, Cap, and Iron Man.
Awesome.
So Iron Man surprised. Over Cap.
Iron Man over Cap only because I was so surprised by how much I liked Iron Man.
Right. Got it.
I mean, I was really, really blown away. Like, that was sort of the opposite of this, where I went in with tremendously low expectations. So if it was even a halfway decent movie, I would have been really wowed. And it was cannot, just...
It cannot be overstated just how boring Iron Man was before the movie.
I mean, yeah, and I've been familiar with that character, and I've read his comics, collected his comics for many, many years. And even I would say... I don't really know why exactly I've been following this character. It's just sort of out of habit. Comics are never very good. They're never so bad that I drop it, but much better movie than it's ever been as a comic, in my estimation.
Excellent. Well, in addition to Survey Says, I want you to also talk about this, when we can expect more from your Stellar series on Conversation Comics with Todd Weber, where you're going through the Chris Claremont, John Byrne era of X-Men. So, shill away, my friend.
Well, we may be slipping into a paradox here, because I think you just heard me on an episode of Conversation Comics with Todd Weber last week, where we discussed for several hours, in fact, about four issues of the Chris Claremont, John Byrne magnum opus on Uncanny X-Men. We looked at the Proteus saga and sort of the first salvo of the Dark Phoenix saga. So lots and lots to unpack there. Just some super dense comics that you don't see nowadays. Hence why it took us so long to discuss them. But we had a lot of fun with that. And we haven't finished the series, so I imagine we'll be doing another one next month. It seems to be sort of a monthly happening now.
I'll just say it's been awesome. Like, it's informative, it's entertaining. It has inspired me to, even though I have access to Marvel Unlimited, I really just want to get all this stuff in floppy form. So I am going to be collecting this all come hell or high water.
I hope you do. And if we've inspired anyone to check out the Apple comics tonight, I think we've done our job, because our love for it is almost tangible. You can reach out and touch it just about. So we've almost like pioneered the art of the live comic read and commentary, and that we literally went page by page this time. And I think we couldn't help it, because we both had them right in front of us and it was easy to do. So we just dove right in with no concerns as to time or pacing or things that might matter for the listener. I'm not sure, but I hope and I am relieved to hear that you're getting something out of that series, because it's so near and dear to my heart and Todd's as well. So that's been a lot of fun. But yeah, I believe, if not last week, that episode will be dropping either this week or the next. So real, real soon. Look for Conversation Comps with, Todd Weber and, joining him again. You mentioned Survey Says. That's the monthly WCW retrospective that I do with my tag team partner, Andy Helene. So basically just a kind of round robin look back at different topics in World Championship Wrestling. So not a real tight structural format of that show. Whatever we feel like talking about on any given month, that's what we do. And coming up in February, looks like we're going to be doing a two-parter, in fact. We have recorded it, but due to the length and how that worked out, probably going to be dropping two shows in February. And I'll go ahead and spoil it. It's a look back at all of the Super Brawls, because tis the season for WCW Super Brawl. So we were joined by a very special guest who you will hear on the show, possibly the most controversial guest in Place to Be Nation history.
Oh my.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I'm going to be tuning into that one. And as I mentioned, when I was on the show, whenever you guys are ready for Alex Wright month, I'm waiting in the chamber.
We'd love to have you back. No doubt.
All right. Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us to talk about Captain America, the First Avenger. We hope that you enjoyed yourself, and we hope the audience enjoyed themselves, and we hope you'll come back and join us for a future installment of Hard Travelers for Hire, perhaps for the Winter Soldier when we get to that point. We have to,
that is the plan.
Work out our schedule to that point, and so we are gonna, what I say now, we are gonna have him on if he's willing for the Winter Soldier.
Yes, that is currently the plan. Yes.
Yes, it would help if I looked at our schedule, I suppose. But Tim, does that sound good to you?
I shall be there.
Awesome, awesome. Well, in the meantime, folks, we're about to head to a commercial break. We hope you have enjoyed the movie. We hope you've enjoyed our talk of the movie. Let us know, as always, what your thoughts were on Captain America the First Avenger on the MCU to this point. And, of course, your rankings to this point in the MCU and our journey here at Hard Travelers for Hire. You can contact us through Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Tim, how can they reach you on Twitter?
You can reach me on Twitter via psyche68. That is CYKE68 on the Twitter.
Absolutely. And, of course, all three of us are active on Place to Be Nation, the Facebook page. Just go to Facebook, go to the search bar, type in Place to Be Nation Comics, join the group. A lot of fun there. And let us know your thoughts. And we hope you stay with us through the commercial. When we come back, we've got reading, watching, we've got the rundown. Stay with us, won't you? Promotional considerations
paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
And now, the Riverdale Carnival presents the Archies.
Take care of the kissing booth while we're singing, Sabrina.
Okay, everybody, here we go with our new hit record.
Sugar! Sugar!
Sugar.
Welcome back, comrades. Get out of here, Colossus. Jeez. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are ready to deliver our usual weekly segments, and let's get started with a look at what we've been doing over the last week or so with a segment we like to call
Read On and Watch On. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
That's right. Reading and watching. And I'm gonna be up front with everybody here. I've in my state of the last week, I did not read a thing. So I have nothing for you this week for reading. But luckily, young Nicholas Walter Vandenberg Duke has got a little something for you. So Nick, why don't you get right into your top three and your bottom one?
Sure. So I'll start off with my bottom one this week, since I'm the only person who has anything. And again, another week where I don't really have, didn't really read a bad book. So if I have to choose a bottom, I'm going with Action Comics 972. I just, haven't generally been a huge fan of this Men of Steel storyline. Not because I don't find the Luthor and Superman dynamic interesting, but because I don't find the villains of, or not the villains, but the antagonists of the God Slayers all that interesting. So that's why it takes home my bottom book of the week.
Digging into your Dan Slott terminology there.
Absolutely. Moving to my top three. At number three, I've got Justice League of America Killer Frost Rebirth number one. I really enjoyed this. I thought this was by far the strongest of the solo Rebirth specials they've done for JLA to this point. The art was great. Steve Orlando's writing of Killer Frost was great. I can't wait to see how he handles her in the main title going forward, if this is going to kind of be the take. It basically deals with Killer Frost's struggle of wanting to do good, but knowing that literally, the way her powers work, she almost has to hurt people in order to stay alive. And so it's this interesting battle for self-preservation and also redemption simultaneously. So it's a very interesting take on the character. Enjoy this one a whole hell of a lot. My number two book of the week, Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 13. You could almost take this issue and put it into the hands of someone who had not read the entirety of the Bottled Light storyline, and it pretty well sums up what's happened in the last five issues. But the slant they put on it, and the framing sequence they use, and the framing device they use, just is such a great reminder of why we love the Green Lantern Corps as a concept. I don't want to spoil anything for you, Greg, but it's a really cool, almost like a Tales of the Green Lantern Corps type feel to this one, where it feels both self-contained and tied into the larger narrative at the same time. Really, really strong work here from Robert Venditti. And then finally, my number one book of the week is Wonder Woman number 15. This is part of the Truth storyline. I think this book is going to be absolutely lauded for its take on mental illness and how it's affecting Diana at this point. I think this is one of the strongest superhero comics on the shelf right now. Liam Sharp continues to knock it out of the park on the art, and I am genuinely intrigued to see how they wrap all this up and what they ultimately reveal is the nature of this fake Themyscira that Diana has been accustomed to for all these years. So continuing to love Wonder Woman a whole hell of a lot. And then go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say excellent. What about your what do we call it?
Quick hits.
Quick hits.
God's sake, Greg.
Oh, I had a brain fart induced by watching this exciting Minnesota Timberwolves basketball game.
How about when we're recording a podcast, you not watch anything and you just focus on the task at hand, Francis?
Well, quite frankly, some of us can multitask. Some of us can't.
Clearly, some of us can't, seeing as how you had a brain fart while trying to watch a damn basketball game that you don't even care about.
He'll appreciate this one. I'm a David Sunday multitasker, where I keep the toothbrush in my mouth but don't actually brush doing a different task and then go back to brushing the tooth later.
And call it, even though you're doing one task at a time, you call it multitasking. I like it. I like it. Anyway, Detective Comics 949. This wraps up the two-part Batwoman Begins storyline. Easily the better of the two issues, I thought. Loved this book. Very intrigued to see what happens with Marguerite Bennett's solo Batwoman title spinning out of this. Teen Titans number 4, perhaps the strongest issue of Teen Titans thus far. I feel like Ben Percy is finally getting a real handle on how to write each of these characters individually. He's had Damian down pretty much from the start, but I like how he writes the other Teen Titans here in this one. Star Wars number 27 continues a pretty cool Yoda flashback story. Enjoying this one. Salvador LaRocca's art stands out. He draws an excellent, excellent Yoda. And finally, Justice League versus Suicide Squad number 6. Much like the rest of this book, nothing right about, but a solid, action-packed event book that also teases the return of a couple of major DC super teams, those being the Justice Society of America, and Kelly Poole's favorite, the Legion of Superheroes. So, enjoyed this one, and interested to see how they pay off those teases going forward.
Excellent. Well, with reading out of the way, and I'll try to read over the next week, so I'll actually have stuff to talk about next week. But with reading out of the way, let's get to what we've been waiting on for over a month now. Watching. Mm-hmm. What have we been watching? And what we've been watching, ladies and gentlemen, is our stories.
Our stories are back. Yep.
Yep. Our stories are back. And we're going to find out what's going to happen with John and Melina now. Are they going to get back together? But before we get to all of those stories, let's get to these other stories, the CW stories. And starting things off last week, coming right out of the gates into the new year, was an episode of Supergirl that was directed by Nick's favorite, Kevin Smith.
Well, I wouldn't say favorite. I mean, he's one of my favorite directors, but favorite is a bit much.
Well, would you or would you not say that he's your favorite Kevin?
Favorite Kevin. Let's see here. I'd have to think about that. Kevin McAllister, also a solid Kevin.
Yeah.
Kevin Green, formerly of the Carolina Panthers and former WCW wrestler, also a strong Kevin.
Kevin, yeah, but I don't think you'd put either of them ahead of Smith, would you? Ooh, what about Nash?
Kevin Nash. Kevin Butler, Hall of Fame kicker for the University of Georgia.
Mm.
You know?
They're good Kevins. Who, Kevin Carter, NFL sack leader, as we learned the other day.
Yeah, from 1999, yeah. There are a lot of good Kevins there in the Kevin Eastman, co-creator of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
There's a lot of Kevin. That's a good point. But in any event, this episode involved Kara and Mon-El getting stuck in an alternate dimension, or not an alternate dimension, an alternate planet, planet,
another planet. Yes.
And they go there, and it's kind of like a version of War World, I guess you would say, where they're having
gladiator type fights. Yeah, so basically they bring back the character of Roulette from earlier this season, and she is now pitching what appears to be some sort of pit fights there on this planet. And they reveal that various people from National City have been going missing, and it's ultimately revealed they've been kidnapped and taken to this planet. And Kara kind of stumbles across it because this woman walks into the offices of CatCo and has a picture of her daughter and is asking for people to basically give her daughter's case some attention since she's been missing for a while. And so Kara decides to investigate, and one thing leads to another, and she ends up on this alternate planet. The daughter in question, by the way, is actually played by Harley Quinn Smith, Kevin Smith's own real life daughter. So
I did not know that.
Yes,
I learned something today. And anyway, so we get that plot going on, the main plot of the episode. The subplot involves Guardian and, a.k.a. James Olsen, and Wynn going out in the field, and Wynn nearly gets himself killed. And so it makes Wynn convinced that he needs to stop helping Guardian. Well, long story short, that didn't last very long. So let's just get right into our thoughts on the episode. I gotta be honest, I was really underwhelmed by this episode. I thought I thought the stuff Mon-El and Kara was amazing and continues to be. They have incredible chemistry. Mon-El has been a fantastic addition to the show, becoming one of my favorite characters other than Kara. So big fan of the Kara and Mon-El stuff. The less impressed by pretty much any of the action in this one. The general plot was uninteresting. It's been done before. I've seen Kara powerless a billion times now, I feel like.
Well, I don't know, a billion times.
Well, okay, a million times. And and then with the Guardian is just not working. Nobody cares about Guardian. Nobody's going to care about Guardian. So I wish they would just jettison it and kill off James Olsen and replace him with Jimmy Olsen. But that's never going to happen. So overall, I mean, there were good things in this episode. Mon-El, again, like I said, really good. I like Roulette a lot, like this version of Roulette. Right off the page, or right off the clean from Justice League Unlimited.
Yeah, very reminiscent of the JLU interpretation.
Yeah, so there were still things to like about this episode, but I think I was a little disappointed given how good Smith's prior foray into the universe had been.
That's fair enough. I enjoyed it a little bit more than you had. I will agree that pretty much anything that didn't involve Mon-El and Kara was pretty weak. To include, like, an already forced brief separation of Alex,
right, and, I forgot about that,
and Maggie, yeah, Sawyer. So, you know, pretty much when it wasn't dealing with Kara and Mon-El, it kind of dragged a little bit. But I really enjoyed most of the stuff that took place on the alien planet. I liked, for you know, getting to see Kara powerless again and getting us, you know, the episode was an opportunity to remind us that she's capable of using her intellect and her courage just as much as she is her strength. So I like those aspects, and the Kara and Mon-El dynamic continues to win me over. So, I wouldn't say that I loved the episode, I would say that I liked it well enough.
She's getting to be so good at overcoming the odds that they're calling her Big Mac Kara now.
Indeed they are. Indeed.
Add that one to the list.
That just made the list.
Yep. So, all right, that brings us into Tuesday and The Flash, the return, the return of two shows, The Flash and Legends of Tomorrow on its new night. Mm-hmm. Now, The Flash came back from that cliffhanger ending from last from the end of the first half of the season, where we found out that in the future, Iris is going to be killed by Savitar, and now Barry is obsessed with preventing this future from happening, evidently not having learned his lesson about messing with the timeline. So Barry and his cohorts are attempting to come up with scenarios in which they can prevent Iris's future death. And what they learn over the course of this episode is that little things that they change in the present can affect the future, although in unpredictable ways. So that's kind of going to be the premise, I think, of the rest of this season, is how Barry and the rest of the team figures out how the dominoes fall, so to speak. A lot to like in this one. I thought it was a fun episode. Getting right back into the character dynamics, H.R. Wells continues to delight with pretty much everything he does and says. Cisco's great again, now that he's not being all mopey. Caitlin was good. They added Julian onto the team, which I think is going to be an interesting dynamic, even though he's annoying at times, but that's going to be his role, clearly. So a lot to like about this episode, I thought.
Yeah, I would agree, including the debut of what, you know, true fans all know will eventually become the Flash Museum, with the opening of the Star Labs, yes, Museum above their underground lair. So, yeah, I really enjoyed this episode. I liked the continuing evolution of the Wally and Barry Flash / Kid Flash dynamic. I liked kind of seeing Wally's enthusiasm at being a recognized superhero and beloved by the city of the people and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, while it wasn't, you know, an excellent episode of The Flash, mainly because I feel like the villain of Plunder was a little bit weak, I would say that it was a very enjoyable episode, and I liked how it kind of focused more on the main narrative of the season rather than, you know, giving too much screen time to a weak villain of the week, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think you may agree with me that the standout, perhaps, of the episode was the hologram version of,
yes,
Cisco talking about
hollow Cisco.
My love of science has got us to this point. And if you too have a love of science, Just phenomenal.
I also thought, as we discussed off air, that it was very interesting how they intentionally focused on H.R. Wells giving the toast at Barry and Iris's housewarming party, and how he magically had, like, this baton thing out of nowhere, lending some credence, I feel, to that theory you brought up a few weeks back about him possibly being abracadabra.
Yes, and there... I can't spoil it, but I've already watched this week's episode of The Flash, and there continue to be little hints here and there about that. There's got to be a reason behind that stick or wand that he keeps carrying around. I'm starting to really suspect that that may be a thing, even if it's not quite as a malicious version of Abracadabra as we're used to from the comics. Also, a little note about the character of Plunder in this episode. Plunder, a.k.a. Jared Murillo, the comic book character Plunder was an alternate universe version of Jared Murillo, who was a Geoff Johns creation, who was a detective that worked on the police force alongside all of the supporting characters of Wally West during his Flash run. So in the comics, Jared Murillo was a pretty major side character in Geoff Johns' Flash run. So interesting that they went with a villainous version of him on here. So,
and you know, while the actor who played Plunder was pretty good, I really felt like they missed the boat by not getting Dusty Rhodes to do it. Probably in season one.
It's Plunder, baby. They clubbering with all kinds of plunder, if you will. That would have been a great thing to see. Dusty Rhodes saying Plunder.
Big Bubber has a bicycle.
Big Bubber, quite fair. You got a bicycle.
Man with a toilet seat.
Toilet seat. Now there's you some good Wikipedia material, Jennifer. Not Wikipedia, YouTube. Go to YouTube.
They wore his old tired ass out.
His tired old ass out. Hey, what's that, baby? Oh, that's a dragon screw leg whip.
That just made the list.
It ain't got nothing to do with no mafia.
That's the Sicilian elbow.
Oh. Doo-doo is good for me, and it's good for you. Very good. In any event, good episode. Now, on to what I thought was the shining star of the week, Legends of Tomorrow, the mid-season premiere, which was an episode that featured a young version of George Lucas. And to describe this episode would be fairly somewhat difficult because there's so much going on here. But it was just a delight from George Lucas being convinced not to make films anymore, thus completely eliminating any value that Ray and Steele have to the team, to the just continued.
Well, Ray explained that though, Greg. I mean, that the butterfly effect of that event is that, you know, the films that inspired them to become
right.
Scientists and archaeologists, respectively, don't exist because of that.
Right. No, I understand, but it's still, you know, it's just humorous. It's silly, and the continued joy of Rip Hunter with an American accent as a wimpy hippie little director guy in the '60s. Damien Darhk and Malcolm Merlyn as the most unlikely comedic duo of all time.
Yeah, Damien Darhk and Malcolm Merlyn with elevator music was pretty damn funny.
Absolutely. The whole episode was really funny, and yet it continued to ground itself in the characters. So you got great moments with Sarah, you know, continuing to be a strong leader. You got the subplot of Heatwave trying to convince or succeeding in convincing Martin Stein to do brain surgery on him, which led to a great bit where they're like, what are you doing? I'm doing brain surgery. What does it look like? And they just walk away. I thought this was an amazing episode. I loved it, every minute of it. It was hilarious. It was filled with references to Howard the Duck, all things, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Star Wars.
Including a climactic action sequence set in the trash compactor, so... Really yep. cool little nods here and there to the work and times of one George Lucas. So,
and also
as a massive Star Wars fanboy, I love the hell out of this. Even if their George Lucas isn't quite as Kermit the Froggy as a lot of the comedic impersonations of him typically are.
And the they even included the line, "You're my only hope," yep. which is a nice little nod. Having not as established earlier in the episode, having not seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, there may have been some Indiana Jones references I didn't get in the episode as well.
Once again, shame, shame, shame.
In any event, so Legends was awesome. That leads us into the Wednesday mid-season premiere of Arrow, which came back from the break after we got seemingly some revelations about Prometheus before the break. This one didn't really focus on Prometheus, though. This was a little bit different, a little focused on the big cliffhanger at the end of the mid-season finale, which was seemingly the return of Laurel Lance. But, and I won't spoil it for those of you that haven't watched it yet, but
thankfully,
all was not
as it seemed to be.
Yes. Thankfully, we dodged a bullet. And I gotta say, there were some fist pumping moments episode. And while some on comics Twitter may have been very upset by a certain scene involving a certain punch, others of us were quite happy with that scene.
Yes.
And wish it would have happened in season two.
And in every subsequent episode since season two.
Yep.
So yeah, I'm not really sure what all we can say about this without spoiling too much, but suffice it to say, I thought the characterizations were strong. For once, yep. I thought that they did a good job of illustrating why Fist was not listening to Oliver. I thought rather than just having her, you know, blindly go against everything he says, I thought this time it actually made sense. Everything felt in step. It feels like they're nailing all the characters. It felt like it felt incredibly focused, even though it was juggling a lot of subplots, mainly because Thea, barely in the episode, Susan Williams, not in the episode at all, so it felt like it knew which subplots it needed to service in this episode and didn't try to do too much. So I really, really enjoyed this episode. Arrow continues to bounce back in a big, bad way.
Yes, definitely. Enjoyed the flashbacks as well.
Oh,
and,
of course.
And thought it was a good episode. Thought that they're And also, I'll say this, Katie Cassidy, again, without spoiling too much, much more believable in the role of an antagonist than she ever was in the opposite.
Antagonist.
So, antagonist. There's a time-honored tradition in our business to refer to villainous characters as antagonists. In any event, now that does it for our DC shows, which we will rank in a moment. But first,
that's not all some of us watched this week. In fact,
that's right.
There was a certain little debut, a certain little show over there on the CW this week that I myself did not watch. And no, it's not because I'm an anti-Archite as some like to suggest. It's just that I just didn't have any interest in the show. But however, Greg did watch the debut episode of Riverdale, and he is here right now to provide you with his fresh, hot takes on the debut episode. Greg, take it away.
It's the sexiest show of new television season. It's Riverdale. Riverdale, where Archie Andrews is inexplicably attractive to every female in the general vicinity of the town of Riverdale. Riverdale! Where Jughead is a blogger who doesn't have an obsession with hamburgers or wear a crown, but mopes around in an emo-like fashion and narrates the episode. Riverdale, where Betty and Veronica kiss each other for no adequately explained reason.
Now wait. Pause. Tell me more.
Well, there were tongues involved. There was very little explanation for it happening except to titillate, which it did, admittedly.
Are we sure this isn't like a fan fiction version of Archie?
Well, I haven't finished yet, because Riverdale, where there is twincest going on.
Oh. What?
Yes, two characters, two twins, have what appears to be a sexual relationship with one another based on the implications in the episode.
There are twin characters in the Archie universe?
Evidently. Okay. Riverdale.
Okay.
Riverdale, where Betty and Archie are best friends, and Betty's obsessed with Archie, but Archie doesn't want to date her because, quote, you're too good for me. You've always been too good for me.
Because Archie's a bad boy.
Yep. Huh. Riverdale, where the teacher seduces Archie and has sex with him in the back of a car.
That's good. That's good.
And of course, Riverdale, where a character gets murdered and the entire town is filled with suspects. Mm. Riverdale,
the Archie murder mystery.
The Archie murder mystery / twincest / statutory rape show on the CW. Riverdale.
Now, you also told me off air, is it true that Archie and Jughead aren't friends on the show?
Right. Archie and Jughead, as best I can. Now, I will confess, I didn't watch the whole episode. I started it about 10 minutes in, and I took a bathroom break in the middle of it, and I came back, and unfortunately it was still on. But from what I can gather, Jughead and Archie are not friends. They're not really close in any real way. Jughead is just the narrator of the show, and he's kind of ironically talking about how crappy Riverdale is. Oh, and I didn't even mention Riverdale, where Veronica, a teenage high schooler, as you would expect to be a high schooler, would be a teenager, comes in and in her first appearance in the show, walks into the diner and introduces herself to Archie and Betty and says, "Are you familiar with the works of Truman Capote? Because this diner is Breakfast at Tiffany's, but this town is so in cold blood."
Oh, God.
We are living in a post-Truman Capote world. So, all I can say is, if you liked Riverdale, like some of the reviewers out there, more power to you. Ben Morris, I know, if you're listening, I know you loved Riverdale. I can't do it. It's a bridge too far. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to go watch the rest of Monday Night Raw.
Well done, sir. Well done. Suffice it to say, given my limited time schedule as it is anyway, I will not be partaking in the Riverdale. I did
want to
catch about
it.
30 seconds of Gotham by accident, and I saw that Jerome kid stapling his face onto his skull, so there's that, of course.
Oh, well, according to some that I've read, Jerome on Gotham is now the best, most accurate to the comics book we've ever got. Mm. He has erased all prior versions of the Joker, according to some in the Twitterverse.
Well, I would suggest to some in the Twitterverse that # Gotham sucks.
Gotham sucks, yep. Oh, we forgot to mention at the beginning of the show that we are, by the way, the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
That's right. Now it's time we rank our CW shows. Are you ready, Nick?
Absolutely.
I am going to go at number one, Legends of Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. At number two, I am going to go with The Flash. At number three, Arrow. At number four, Supergirl. And at number 115, Riverdale.
Absolutely. I'm going to go Legends of Tomorrow at one, Arrow at two, Flash at three, and Supergirl at four.
Very good, Mr. Lau. And with that being said, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, that wraps up reading and watching.
Indeed it does. And so we're moving on to our other recurring segment. You know it as...
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the
Boy, I wonder who was supplying the guitar there in that song. Must have been a pretty fair little guy there. Must have been pretty.
Are you
going to
ask that rhetorical question every time we do that jingle from now on?
Who said it's rhetorical? I genuinely wonder who it was.
Not to toot your own horn, but toot toot
toot toot. There we go. All right, let's move on into the rundown, our weekly look at the news notes around the comic book landscape. And let's start out in an area that we don't talk about nearly enough, video games. That's right, folks, video games. We've got a big announcement this week as Marvel Entertainment, where our good friend Ben Morris is one of the head honchos, and Square Enix, or Enix, announced that they have formed a video game partnership with one another, and it's going to be kicked off with an Avengers game. It's been dubbed the Avengers Project, and will be developed by Square Enix in conjunction with the Deus Ex game developer Eidos Montreal and Tomb Raider developer Crystal Dynamics.
Right.
We got a trailer that showed Bruce Banner's glasses, Captain America's shield, Thor's hammer, and Iron Man's armor, also Iron Man's armor, along with a voiceover suggesting that the Avengers have been inactive for some time in the world of the game. We don't know anything else about this Avengers game. We don't know if it's going to be a role-playing game a la Kingdom Hearts. We don't know if it's going to be an action RPG, kind of like something along the lines of Ultimate Alliance. We don't know if it's going to be an Arkham-style game. We don't know anything about it, really, or an adventure game like Tomb Raider. But this is a pretty major announcement. The game is not expected out until 2018, probably, at the earliest. But it looks like this could be the next wave of Marvel video games, which there's been a dearth of Marvel console games in recent years. So, Nick, your thoughts on this announcement? I know it's pretty exciting to me.
Yeah, absolutely, very exciting. Not necessarily just for the Avengers game that was announced, but more so for the fact that it's going to be a continuing partnership, and it kind of marks, you know, Marvel's recommitment to true, quote-unquote, triple-A titles in the video game sphere once more. The various reports indicate that the games that are going to be published as part of this partnership are all going to tie in together, and it almost feels, Greg, like they're setting up their own distinct Marvel video game universe, much like a Marvel cinematic universe. The key distinction here being Marvel retains all of the video game rights to its characters so that they could, have all these different games featuring individual heroes or individual subplots that all tie into a larger narrative. That it's a really cool approach. I think there's a lot of potential here, and something that there hasn't really been a lot of in the video game sphere, so to speak.
Yeah, interesting. And the only question that I would have out of it is, does this limit the potential for us to get an Ultimate Alliance 3 potentially? Because I'm just hoping against hope that one day Marvel will see it in their interest to make such a game. Because then again, I understand the days of the offline multiplayer game are likely doomed, but some of us still enjoy playing those. So, I hope that this means we can get multiple different styles of games as well, as opposed to just one size fits all.
Right, and with it being an ongoing partnership, I think you'll see that a variety of approaches and a variety of games released. And while this is, obviously a partnership with Square Enix and not Activision, who was behind the Marvel Ultimate Alliance games, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see, maybe not a true sequel to Marvel Ultimate Alliance, but something of a spiritual sequel, something along in that vein, come out of this partnership.
All right, well, let me put you on the spot, Nick. If you had a dream Marvel video game, what would it be?
A dream Marvel video game. Let me think on that one for a moment.
Yo, let me speak on this. Odale.
I think there is a lot of potential. I'll give you two answers. One, a biased answer, and one unbiased answer. A Thor game done in the style of God of War, where it's just a badass beat-em-up action game that is completely over the top, and you can go to all these, fantasy, the Nine Realms and whatnot. I think that has a ton of potential. But then I think there's a lot of potential in a good Iron Man game that had armor customization options, where you would essentially be able to truly build your own armor rather than a scaled-down version that they attempted in some of the movie tie-in games. Like, complete with almost like how in some of the racing games you can create your own car, and some of the Grand Theft Autos you can customize your own character. Basically, build your own Iron Man suit and go around, upgrading it with various different parts of armor that would actually genuinely affect how the game is played. I think that's got a lot of potential as well.
I like it. I like both of those ideas. Mine, I would like to see a sandbox game. And this is, again, this is a dream game. I don't think the technology exists to even make this the way that it would be, you know, potentially to make it. But I would like to see a sandbox-style game a la GTA or whatever that takes place in the Marvel Universe that allows you to select from a variety of characters from different realms. If you want to play in the X-Men universe, if you want to play in the Avengers universe, if you want to play in the Fantastic Four universe for some unknown reason, if you want to do the galactic side of Marvel, that would allow you to play as maybe one of like 8 or 9 different characters in the game and kind of go between different worlds, so to speak, of the Marvel Universe. So a sandbox game would be my thought. But I like both of your ideas a lot.
Thank you.
So let's move on from the video game to the world of film. And we got some, well, quite frankly, alarming news this week. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. Pretty surprising announcement. And that is that Ben Affleck will not direct Batman. He has backed out of the project as a director. As for now, he's still planning on starring in it and producing it, and co-wrote the first draft of the script with Geoff Johns. But he has backed out of the role. He put out a statement saying that he couldn't focus on he couldn't put as much attention on the role if he was directing it, basically. So he decided to step back and is still going to help the studio to find a director. Now, that all sounds good. The prepared statement sounds wonderful. But just a few weeks ago, he was on Jimmy Kimmel saying that he was going to direct it. And now that, you know, evidently has been proven untrue. So, look, is it the end of the world? No. I mean, they could still find a great director to come in, and he could still play the character, and the script could still end up being good. The script, by the way, right now, according to reports, being rewritten by Chris Terrio, who is a longtime collaborator with Affleck, also the writer of both Justice League movies that are being planned. But let's be honest here. I have been the champion of Ben Affleck's Batman movie from the day it was even rumored. I just thought Ben Affleck directing, not just starring. Quite honestly, Ben Affleck starring as Batman was less important to me than Ben Affleck directing a Batman movie. And that rug has been pulled out from under me. And the DC Cinematic Universe has not given me any reason to be optimistic about it. Zero. I have nothing to go on right now except blind loyalty to the characters. And, I mean, look, right now, I got to be honest. My expectations have just been lowered dramatically for this whole project. And I read an article on Forbes as well today that raised some more concern with me about the writer Mark Hughes, who has been blindly supportive of the DCU, even giving Suicide Squad rave reviews. And even he is talking about how his doubts are starting to creep in because he's heard rumors that Affleck may depart the DC Cinematic Universe after this Batman movie. So he doesn't know if that's true, but he said he thinks the odds are increasing. So I don't know if any of the scuttlebutt is true. I don't know what's true or what's not true. All I know is what we see every week in the headlines, and it's all bad news every week. It's a director leaves The Flash again. Oh, 3 times now, or whatever it is. The director leaves Batman. Okay, Wonder Woman lost its first director. Constant script rewrites. Constant, which is a normal thing in Hollywood, but we saw what the script ended up turning into with both Suicide Squad and the theatrical version of Batman vs. Superman. We saw what got done that movie in editing. We're continuing to see certain projects that haven't even gotten off the ground that have been talked about for years, such as Shazam, which it appears now that we're going to get a Black Adam movie before we get a Shazam movie. just I don't know, Nick. Am I going too hard on this story? But it's just, I don't know. I got to be honest. This bummed me out because I was so excited about Affleck directing this film.
I completely agree with pretty much everything you said. I don't really know what else to add to that. I mean, like you said, it's not so much this story by itself. It's when you take it as part of the larger whole. And it's been nothing but a barrage of disconcerting news pretty much for the last, you know, year or so, pretty much since Batman v Superman came out. You know, I figured there had to have been something up, because when there are repeated, persistent rumors or something for so long, they're usually out there for some sort of reason. Usually, not always. And the Affleck thing was something that no matter how many times he tried to assuage fears or whatnot, it kept popping back up, and clearly there was something to it all along. Now my hope is that, my ultimate fear is if, like you mentioned, the Forbes article turns out to be true and he does wind up departing the cinematic universe altogether, that's the only part of the DCCU that has kind of been universally enjoyed. So what becomes of the entire plan if Affleck walks? I don't want to overblow this, but I think the whole thing is on shakier footing than it has been in the public perception for some time.
To that point, we also got more, let's be honest, bad news this week. Flash movie that was planned for 2018. I say was planned because now it is being rewritten, completely rewritten, by screenwriter Joby Harold, a page one rewrite, according to Variety, that involves substantial changes to the script that could include changes to characters, story, and structure. There ain't no way this movie's getting made and put out in 2018. It's
not with the level of visual effects that will be needed for a Flash movie, no.
No. They have it currently scheduled for March 16th, 2018. No way. Not going to happen. And now it looks like the Batman is not going to happen in 2018, in all likelihood. So, I mean, it's when you go back and look at what Warner Brothers announced not that long ago, it's been somewhat of a disaster to this point. Their schedule is not anywhere near what they said it was going to be, and clearly, their planning was not to the level that it needed to be to set this whole thing up. So, hopefully, Wonder Woman comes out and is a hit and delivers and provides what we're looking for. Hopefully, Justice League is at least solid. But man alive, it's tough to be excited about this cinematic universe right now.
Agreed. But hey, we have a Black Manta, so
yay. That's the interesting thing. The one movie that has not already been made that seems to be developing well is Aquaman.
Of all things.
Or Aquaman.
Indeed.
The get down actor Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. Is in talks to star in Aquaman as Black Manta, one of Nick's and my favorite villains in the DC universe. I haven't ever actually seen this guy act, but everybody's excited about it. So everybody says that it's a great hire. He'll join Jason Momoa, Amber Heard, Willem Dafoe, Patrick Wilson, and this film is set for release on October 5, 2018. I wouldn't be surprised if it comes even earlier than that. Because they really seem to be making headway on this one, and which is a surprise given what you would think would be some of the difficulties of making an Aquaman film. But hey, looks like things are going well on this one, so hopefully this will not have any unforeseen issues the way that the other movies have. If the trend continues, we could see James Wan walk away at any point now. Hopefully that doesn't happen.
Well, if you remember, there were rumors of that there for a little while as well, so. You know, hopefully it doesn't happen, but I like this move, you know, getting the news out that Black Manta is officially in the movie and is being cast, because it gives me hope that they will, like we mentioned when they announced the Patrick Wilson casting, I am hoping that Ocean Master will not even be an antagonist in this movie. I'm hoping they're actually you know, relatives and friends for this movie.
Yes.
Set up for the sequel the way that, you know, Green Lantern should have done back in 2011. One other thing I wanted to mention, Greg, I did read a report that's bullshit, but the rumor right now is that Nicole Kidman will also be joining the cast of Aquaman. I do not remember the site where I read that, but apparently she is being considered for the role of Atlanta, Arthur Curry's mother, and former Queen of Atlantis.
Yes, which, hey, that's on me. No problem.
Absolutely.
Sounds good, and that would be good.
Her return to the DC Cinematic Universe after her role as
Dr. Meridian
in Batman Forever, which I would remind you, peak Nicole Kidman, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I would agree with you on that. As you know, we're not going to get into that. Well, that's another topic for another podcast. Perhaps when we do an episode of Get Assy Together, we can delve into Nicole Kidman's career.
Absolutely. But speaking of women making their return to the DC Universe, Greg.
Oh, now this I will talk about. Because while my on and off, my finicky feelings towards Nicole Kidman have changed over the years, my feelings towards this woman have not. The legendary, the gorgeous, the wonderful, the greatest Lois Lane of them all, Terry Hatcher.
You mean you're taking Terry Hatcher over cigarette-smoking Margot Kidder?
I am. And now I will say this. I call her the greatest Lois of all, but I think I've also called Erica Durant's that, and they're pretty close. But in terms of my heart, Terry Hatcher must always be number one because of what she meant to my burgeoning youth. She will be joining the cast of Supergirl in the role of an unnamed villain for an arc this season. And this is amazing. Andrew Kreisberg even says that Terry Hatcher is his all-time favorite Lois Lane, so he clearly has great taste. She and Erica Durant's cut above the rest. Anyway, Terry is going to join the cast as a villain. I can only hope that she interacts with Dean Cain's character, who of course plays Kara's adoptive father on the show. So this is really exciting news for me. I'm happy to see it. Stoked that the people in charge of Girl are embracing Superman's past the way that they have.
Yeah, absolutely. While I, you know, am not the Lois and Clark fan that you are, I do think it's pretty cool that they've brought in various actors who have had a tie to the Supergirl or Superman mythos over the years, whether it be Helen Slater playing, Kara's mom. You also had Linda Carter. You have Dean Cain, as you mentioned, Terry Hatcher. Very cool casting nod. Something they kind of did over on The Flash as well. So shows that these people have a real reverence for the shows that have come before, and it's always cool to have those little nods that are just in there for the fans. So I like this move.
Chilly. No, I'm excited for it. Should be interesting to watch. I don't know. I was trying out a new way of saying totally, and I don't think it really worked. It made me feel a little too, I don't know, tubular, I guess you would say. Is that what the kids say these days, tubular?
It sounded a little bit like one of the least funny at Saturday Night Live recurring sketches of all time, The Californians.
The Californians. Thank you, Nick. I also hate that sketch. Oh, I can hear you on. I can hear Twitter now at D Phillips 865Q at Nick Duke 87. Oh, the Californians ain't funny, huh? Listen, it's just our opinion, folks. We're not trying to split the damn atom here. For God's sake, it's just an opinion.
Just happens to be a correct opinion. Californians suck.
Well.
There it is.
Oh, I'm getting an alert, Nick.
Yes. Yes.
Let's see what it says here.
Hit me with it.
Futures are down. Okay. Bull market. No, I don't care about that. Oh! Ho-Ho Loon still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment. Ladies and gentlemen. Oh, my. This has been your Ho-Ho Loon ticker update. Here at the Hard Traveling Fanboy Studios in lovely, seasonal, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Now, Folks, we hope you've enjoyed this episode. As we mentioned before the break, come to the Face to Be Nation, the Facebook Place to Be Nation, rather, comics page, Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook.com, and join us and talk about all the happenings in the world of comics and also our shows, of course. Nick, tell the good folks what they can expect in the near future from us.
Right, so the rest of the month of February, we will be making up for all the aggression and anger we poured out during Hate Month by giving you Love Month. So for the next 3 weeks, we're going to be taking a look exclusively at things that we absolutely love. We kick that off next week with a long book hunt on the greatest Green Lantern story of all time, the Sinestro Corps War. We follow that up in 2 weeks with a very special edition of Off the Page for what both Greg and I consider to be the finest DC animated standalone movie of all time, Batman Under the Red Hood. And we finish off the month with a countdown of our top five Marvel Comics stories of all time.
Can't wait for that. Can't wait for all that. It's a time for love. It's a time for the heart-traveling fanboys to return. And we are excited to bring to you some of the things that we just absolutely adore. Unrelated to that, we are also in talks with amongst ourselves to possibly do a return to the world of Spider-Man Unlimited. that should be a fun experience if we choose to go there. We're also talking about a project that will involve the entire Place to Be Nation pop crew that we'll tell you about a little bit later when we get more of the details shored up.
Right. So, it's a project that wouldn't see the light of day for many months. So nothing too pressing there, but I think it's got some potential. It's got some potential.
It's got legs. Well, with all that being said, folks, we hope you've enjoyed the show. Let us know your thoughts on Captain America the First Avenger, on the DC Cinematic Universe, on the Weekly Hall of Comics. What do you want to hear on the show in the future? What would you like us to review, talk about? Let us know. And with that being said, I am Greg Phillips. He is Nick Duke. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and be sure to go out and read some comics.
Unlike Greg.